Welcome into the latest edition of ESPN FC. I'm Kay Murray, joined in the studio by Craig Burley and Stevie Nicol. And what a game we witnessed at Stamford Bridge between Chelsea and Manchester United. It saw Cole Palmer scoring in the 100th and 111th minute for Chelsea to secure the epic 4-3 victory against a Manchester United side who themselves had at one point come from 2-0 behind. This is what it means for the table. Chelsea find their way into the top 10 and Manchester United remain in six as it stands. Let's welcome in Frank Leboeuf to talk more about this, but Craig, let me start with you. What a wild game it ended up being.
Well, yes, and that's what happens when you have two big clubs who have spent a fortune and are still a shambles. And that's what you get, a chaotic match that neither can control from start to finish. And if you want to try and go through the match and pick it apart a little bit, excellent from Chelsea at the start, not from United. You know, go 2-0 up, cruising, probably could have gone 3 up. An errant pass from a guy who's short of confidence in Caicedo. United are back in it. Then bad defending from, I think it was from a Chelsea set piece that ends up with United up the field, overload at the back post. Before you know it, it's 2-2. I mean, it was almost like United were so bad in the first 30 minutes, Chelsea went, hold on a minute, that's supposed to be us. We're the team, we can out-shamble you, have a look at this. And they let them back into the game, and then that just allowed for a very open, chaotic second half of football, and we saw how the game finished. Pochettino was looking like a dead man walking until he was bailed out at the end. And then it was Ten Hag again, who I think is, you know, I don't think there's much debate that any of us are just going to, and any talk of the top four, you know, even with a win at Stamford Bridge tonight, I think was a forlorn expectation. That was pipe dream sort of stuff. They're never getting anywhere near the top four, and he won't be near this Manchester United hot seat next year, I don't think.
Utter chaos, Stevie. What did you take away from it?
Well, listen, it was a great game to watch because of it. Because neither team can control anything for any period of time. And when you have Chelsea, albeit trying to go forward, the number of times they coughed the ball up absolutely played into United's hands. That's what they want. I mean, that's just what United is. United's a team that will wait till you make a mistake and then try and use the pace, particularly Garnacho on that left-hand side. And then they took advantage of that. So, for the two coaches sitting on the bench, let me tell you something. This is an absolute nightmare. Because you're panicking. Because both sides, when they went forward, looked as though they were going to score or they were going to create. And it was just that and that. As I said, great to watch, but from a technical point of view, these two teams are absolutely where they should be in the league. And the fact that at any stage, United thought they would get in the top four. As Craig said, no, you're delusional.
What did you call it? The Battle of the Shambles?
It was the Battle of the Shambles, which looked like Chelsea were going to come out just slightly less shambolic, which they did in the end. But
I don't know.
Badia Shield, I don't know what Frank thinks about some of the defending, particularly from the Chelsea side or the Man United side, but it was all over the place.
Frank?
Well, I'm with the guys. You know, when I sat down and I said, what am I going to say? You know, I'm very circumspect about what I saw today with, you know, of course, like Stevie said, I enjoyed the game because it was fun to watch. But when you go a little bit deeper, oh, my God, it's a nightmare. And I would be more severe towards Manchester United because at least they have some players we can call experienced players. And you are 3-2. And they don't know how to handle the end of the game. And when you see Dalot making that foul, but at 3-3, they are also Chelsea has a counter-attack at 4-2. And it's because Jackson doesn't give the correct ball to Sterling, that Sterling cannot score. That's not what I want to see professionally talking. Chelsea, I'm going to be wise with them because, you know, I've been severe with them last game. They are an academy team. They are learning. Some people are saying that we start from scratch and we learn from there. Yeah, they spend $1 billion, but it is what it is. But really, that's not the way I see football. when I see professional players, defensively was a nightmare. But not only for Badiashile or Dizazi or some others. On the second goal with Bruno Fernandes, you have, I think it's Nicolas Jackson and Mudrić with Bruno Fernandes. And as Bruno Fernandes goes toward the goal, nobody follows him. They don't care. They're not concerned. They don't want to see that. Whatever. Of course, the first goal, Caicedo. I mean, so many times we saw that. And so many times we see that during the game. But again, I go back to Manchester United. The last goal, how that possible? And the 100 minutes of the game that you're not there getting the draw and not being concerned as Manchester United players were. That's crazy. That makes no sense for me. That game was fun to watch. But yeah, if you go deeply, that's as Craig mentioned, that was a real shamble.
I don't want to hear any words from Pochettino now talking about. I know he was on the winning side. Well, listen, we're on the front foot. We're going in the right direction. This was a great win. Oh my God, no, I don't. As Frank said, dig a bit deeper. It was, you got out of jail with this one because this team, this United side, just gifted you back into this game with their inability to just do the basics at the end. And from United's perspective, you've got to give them some credit in some sense because they already lost a bunch of defenders. They lost Varane on the game. Evans comes on at 36, whatever. He has to go off. And they're already playing with 10 men. And I mean that in the nicest possible way when they don't have the ball. Because Casemiro has gone. Gone. Properly gone. Cannot move. You can walk through the middle of that park. And to be fair, you could to both teams. But from United's perspective, you could walk through the middle of that park. He cannot get around the field. And when he goes home, when they go home tonight and they fly home, he can sit there and think, well, you know, I've got this big long contract that they gave me. They brought in two hugely experienced players. Casemiro and then Amrabat. And you'd have to argue now that looking at Casemiro, they can't play any of them. They're probably going to have to play Maino and McTominay unless Ten Hag all of a sudden thinks Casemiro's going to be able to get about the field. So you look at the recruitment again. I know it's not nothing to do with Ineos or just in, but you look at that. He's two international footballers, one who's not playing and the other one who is just sauntering around the field. He either can't get around or is not willing to get around. That was, to me, I don't know about you, Steve, to me that was obvious tonight, particularly early on.
When he came off, I don't know whether you remember, Kay, when he came off, I turned to Kay and I said, I hope he's playing on Sunday.
He did.
And I'm really surprised because with the experience that he's got, as a player, when you can't get around and you're getting overrun, when you're the experienced guy in the middle of the park next to an 18-year-old, then you bring everybody in and you tighten the ship up. And basically what you're saying is, right, if they're going to get at us, they're going to have to go round the outside. We're going to block this up in the middle. And then what you're doing is you're sending a message to your defenders that they know what's happening. As opposed to right now, or what's been happening all season, the back four, whoever it may be, whether it's been Evans or anybody else, they have no idea where the attack's coming from because the middle of the park doesn't shove them to the left and don't shove them to the right, or they don't block the middle and don't make them go wide. There's holes everywhere. And so no wonder United are losing goals because as a unit, they have no idea where and when it's coming at them. And there's a reason why the best teams win games when they're tight, because they do the basics well. And when I say they do the basics well, they 100 times out of 100 times. The fact that they lose the game because of everybody going to sleep is absolute nonsense. The people who are good at football and become professionals, the reason they don't play at the top, never mind the ability, it's the basics. Passing, control, doing your job. You do those three things, you can be a professional footballer. And if you do them at a certain level, you'll play for Man City or Arsenal or Liverpool. But you can't turn up and produce that when you play for Manchester United That just tells you that it's the players on the field. You can't blame Ten Hag for what happened with that last goal. That's the players on the field.
Yeah, but what about, maybe you could blame... And I say this kind of tongue-in-cheek, but not in today's forum that we sort of watch the football in, is all this talk every time. And we saw it for those that saw the Man City game yesterday against Aston Villa. The most shambolic set-piece wall that Villa put up from the Phil Foden goal when Zaniola turned his back. Now, all we hear about these days from, shall I call them, footballing nerds? If there's a more plausible terminology, help me out. But all we hear about is, well, the set-piece coach there for Arsenal, the set-piece coach did this and he did that and he did this. Isn't this wonderful? Anybody talking about it last night with the set piece with the wall? Anybody talking about the set piece coach for Man United? Everybody hides their head under a bushel when it goes badly, but when it goes well, it's always the set piece coach. And you know, at the end of the day, we shouldn't read. What I'm saying is, we shouldn't read too much into the roles these people have, because at the end of the day, it comes down to, and that's where people get carried away. Oh, this is just wonderful, the set-piece guy and the throw-in coach, isn't this? At the end of the day, Stevie said, it boils down to how players react on the field.
You make decisions. When you're on the field as a player, you can do all your coaching, all your walkthroughs and all your run-throughs and all your shape and all the other things. But things happen and you have to make a decision. And as I said, the best players make good decisions the majority of the time. These two teams are full of players who make bad decisions the majority of the time. That's what you saw today.
Frank?
Yeah, that's what it is. I think that's where I'm concerned about those two teams. In football, and especially in our sport, we take initiatives. And that's very crucial in our game. And one player taking an initiative tactically, collectively, defensively, it's also very important than a striker who's going to score a goal because suddenly he's going to not control a ball or volley the ball instead of controlling it. That's what it is. That's why our game is special comparing to maybe other games where you have the tactic, what the coaches say, and like in basketball, we do the fourth, we do the third, the second, whatever it is, and they stick to that. In football, you have to deal with elements that you're not in control of. So it's about initiative, anticipation. And those two teams, they make bad decisions in a way that, for example, Palmer today, who scored 3 goals, was definitely for me the best player, the best Chelsea player. He sometimes takes bad decisions because he knows that he has to save the club in a way. That's the only one where maybe has that level where he can take decision. And he makes maybe too much decision on his own and sometimes tries to shoot because he feels that if he gives the ball to somebody else, he's not going to score. So it's where you have to work at it. It's where you have to feel it. He's still young, so it's, of course, excusable what he does. But you have to have that feeling. And those two teams, most of players don't have that feeling. They take bad decision. They don't secure defensively and they rush offensively. And so sometimes it's fantastic, but most of the time it's bad to see.
Cole Palmer, where would they be without him right now?
Wow.
16th? 15th, 16th? I mean, that's how much they've relied on him. You know, ultimately, somebody who was rejected in the end by Manchester City, which is not the worst thing in the world because they have a big squad, but I thought he got... As the game went on, he started to make... As Frank said, he tried to force it a little bit, some of the passing, and it was a little frustrating, but there's no doubt he's the guy that's carrying the can for them, but, you know, there's no... I would not trust either of these sides, either of them. If you said to me, Chelsea
against anybody,
Chelsea were anybody. Up twice against Burnley at the weekend, got pegged back at home again, and in some sense got away with this one tonight. Now I have no idea what the end game is for Pochettino, and that really is going to be the big stories here is the managers, because players will survive for the most part But, you know, we've seen and heard some crazy rhetoric from Erik ten Hag over the course of 7 or 8 months this year, for sure. Last year was pretty sensible from him. This year has gone full circle. And he's got Liverpool at the weekend. And he always seems to me one of those managers, again, he's back in that category of just when you think he's dead, he survives with some sort of a performance, which was the Liverpool FA Cup game.
Yep.
It's Liverpool again at the weekend. But you got to think Liverpool have learned some great lessons of their wastefulness from that game, which it was, and gave United an opportunity to get back in, which they took. But, you know, he's dangling, Ten Hag. There is no doubt about it. He is dangling. And you know, it's not just Chelsea who are not a good side creating chances. We talk about this every day. I would say if they played Sheffield United at the bottom of the league, Burnley or Luton Town, which they did recently, and Luton created a
load of chances,
barrel of chances against them, I would be confident any of those sides would say, do you know what, let's go toe-to-toe with this Man United side. And I kind of think that's where they are.
Ten Hag said his team deserved to win tonight.
Why?
Could you make an argument?
I really would love to know why.
Because, well, they're in a position to win.
Because
they're in a position to win.
Exactly.
Right.
But that's not. But being in a position and deserving to win.
That's a completely different matter. Than, you know, they got back in the game through nothing that they did. Which is hard on Garnacho, but it's the truth. They were getting run around for 34 minutes, and then Garnacho was alive. Alive to a situation that may happen. And he pounced on it. That had nothing to do with Manchester United or Erik ten Hag or any of the coaching staff. It had nothing to do with it. Chelsea just said, on you go, you can come back in the game. Now, they took advantage of getting the goal, and they took advantage of a Chelsea side that when things get bad, they have no idea what to do. And so from there, it was a level game. Because we've just sat here and told you about the whole game. From that point on, it was back and forth. So you can't really honestly turn round and say we deserve to win the game. Because the truth is, other than a two-minute spell after you scored, at no stage were Manchester United regarded this game. If anybody had any claim to be in charge, it would be Chelsea for the first half an hour. But Manchester United had no control on this game at all. None. So, other than you got yourself ahead with 2 minutes to go, you threw it away, or you dropped 2 points. But don't come out and say you deserve to win this game. That's just not true.
Do you know, Chelsea, Man United, the last 20 years or so, 20 years or so, been one of the big showcase games of English football in the last 20 years. Really and truly, all that was at stake today was discussions about managers' jobs, really and truly. Because where are Chelsea going to end up? They're not going to get relegated. They're not going to get into Europe. They're at best mid-table. And but for a few delusional souls out there, Man United will be playing, you know, Europa League football next year. That's where they were going to be, win, lose or draw today. And so really what we're looking at here is a fixture between two big spenders and two big hitters in England. And the main topic is which manager's going to survive, because they're not playing for it. They're not playing. It's not a league title at stake. They're not. There's not really a top four at stake. There is not, because United are not good enough to get in there and bridge that gap. And by the way, their goal difference is worse anyway. That's another point. So really, what we're talking about here is two managers trying to save their backsides. And on tonight's showcasing, Pochettino just about saved his, because when United were winning and it was going into injury time, it looked like he was going to be the man answering all the questions. But in the end, at the end, it's Ten Hag who's doing it again. So it's quite sad, really, to see where we are with these two clubs.
If we stick with the managers, Frank, and we talk about the risk it would be to keep Pochettino at Chelsea, or the risk it would be to keep Erik Ten Hag at Manchester United, which would be worse?
For me, it would be to keep Ten Hag. I mean, again, as I explained before, he has he has the players that he needs to compete in the right way. If he has the player spot on, tactically prepared and everything. Pochettino has a real task because of the inexperience of the player and a fair inconsistency. It's why I would say that Pochettino can be guilty at some point, but not most of the point. I don't want to blame Pochettino for what it is. When he signed, I say, well, yeah, okay, he signed, but what he can do? There is nothing much he can do. You have to wait for the players to get more experience and to not do silly mistakes like we saw Caicedo. I mean, the first 30 minutes of the game, as Stevie explained, nothing much to say. It's until Caicedo decided to do that stupid horizontal pass to Garnacho that Chelsea came into danger. But from Ten Hag, I don't feel the involvement of that team. I think we reached the end of it because we can feel the atmosphere out there, that some players, the experienced players, don't fight for the club anymore, or maybe only against the coach. So Ten Hag, I think it might be the time to change, because to refresh, I think, the dressing room.
Frank, just real quick, did you have any issue with either of the penalties today?
Well, you know, the most I watched the first one, you know, I really think that there is a penalty. But at first I say, oh, the knee against the knee is very light. And I would have said, no, maybe it really depends on the referee. But I think Okura went down easily, I would say. The second one, no, I have no problem. You know, there is a kick from Dalot on the Madueke right foot. And okay, he fails maybe a little bit later, but it's because of the run. And if you watch it live, there is no, for me, no problem for the penalty. But the first one, I'm still doubting to give 100% penalty.
Penalties for you?
I think once you get wrong side like that, then at that pace, any sort of contact is, you know, they're going to give it as a penalty. So, strangely enough, I didn't think the one at the weekend was, when Burnley and Vincent Kompany wasn't happy. But I think that was more of an arm on an arm sort of thing, almost like a brushing together with the top half of the body, but the bottom half is a different scenario. So, yeah, I never felt they were going to be reversed once VAR looked at
them. Well, that's the question. If they hadn't been given on the pitch, would VAR have overturned?
No, they wouldn't have anyway. No. Not unless it's clear and obvious that it wasn't. And you can't see that looking at both of them. And again, just to double down on what Craig's saying, as a defender, when you get caught on the wrong side, it's your responsibility not to get tangled up. Full stop. Mm. Any good coach will tell you that. Once you're in the wrong side, you can't touch them. You can't touch them, because there's no argument. You have no argument as a defender.
Well, Diego Dalot, for the Madueke penalty, he's a quick defender, Dalot, but he's got everybody. You know, United had everybody back, pretty much. He's got everybody to his right-hand side. I know Madueke's left-footed, so he may, I don't want him to come in and shoot, but you're taking him into, you know, six or seven red jerseys there. Once you show him down the line, it's one-on-one. That's a risk. I mean, you know, it's six and two threes, I suppose, if he comes inside and bends it in the top corner. But that's a difficult skill to do, particularly when you have so many players back. He made a conscious decision to show him down the line, and he got done. He got done by the change of pace, the drop of the shoulder. And he never complained, by the way, Dalot, when he was down. It was Fernandes and the others that were complaining. Dalot knew that, but you can always tell by the reaction. You know, Anthony was that, very guilty, and Dalot, no complaints whatsoever. He knew he'd been done, he knew it was wrong side. But still, that being said, there's no excuse for United switching off, even from the position they were in at 3-3. They switched off from the set piece, and that's what done them in the end.
Just a little note. Again, the good teams, when somebody makes a mistake the way Dalot did, there's always somebody there to bail him out. There wasn't a red jersey came across to help Dalot. Not one.
We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't a search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/FC. Just go to Indeed.com/FC right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on the podcast. Indeed.com/FC, terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Tired of ads interrupting your favorite sports podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music, included with your Prime membership. Amazon Music offers the most ad-free top podcasts. Enjoy shows like First Take, Pardon the Interruption, and The Low Post, available ad-free and uninterrupted. To start listening, download the Amazon Music app or go to amazon.com/ESPN pods. That's amazon.com/ESPN pods to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, this is ESPN's Mike Greenberg, and ESPN Bet is ready to take you through all the biggest sports moments this spring. The official sports book of ESPN has exclusive offers and markets from Scott Van Pelt, Stephen A. Smith, and me. From the playoff intensity to finally getting out to the ballpark, there's no better time for sports fans. Sign up today, and new users get $100 in bonus bets for making any sportsbook bet. Download ESPN Bet today. What a play.
Must be 21 plus and present in select states. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Terms and conditions apply. See app for details.
Liverpool returned to the top of the Premier League, but it wasn't always comfortable in their 3-1 win over bottom of the table. Sheffield United, Darwin Nunez charging down an attempted clearance from Gerbich to open the scoring in the 17th. In the second half, Liverpool were given a scare when Conor Bradley scored an own goal, but then came a super strike from Alexis McAllister, followed by a great Cody Gakpo header, and Liverpool went back on top of the table. Stevie, you and I watched this game together, and you used the word lucky. Can we use the word lucky in a 3-1 win?
Lucky's probably the wrong word. Look, you look at the stats, and it's got 83-17. I mean, it's total and utter domination. But again, you've got to look at the facts. Liverpool created one clear chance in this game, and that was the third goal. All that possession, they couldn't break Sheffield United down. And when they lost the goal to make it 1-1, it was hard to see... It was hard to see where it was coming from. And that's why I said about Salah. You know, it's 1-1, you've just lost a goal, 60 minutes in, you need a goal. I would have thought Salah's the guy you leave on. Because Salah, on many occasions, hasn't taken part in a lot of games. And if he has, he hasn't done well. But this is a guy that scores goals. If nothing else, he scores goals. So I was really surprised when he took him off. Now, at the end of the day, as Craig said in the highlight, well, the substitutes made a difference. Well, they did. But I wouldn't have taken Salah off. In the end, it looks good. 3-1, all the possession. But I can assure you, myself and probably about 60,000 people at Anfield, once that equaliser went in, weren't too sure if really, really was going to get turned around.
You weren't sure when it was 2-1. You were still a little bit worried, saying they needed another goal at that point.
Well, Liverpool give chances. They give it opportunities to anybody who comes to Anfield. I mean, you saw the first opportunity that McAtee had. I mean, my goodness, you've got to score that. But kind of typically, when you're playing against a side that are bottom of the league, there's a reason, because they can't score. And the chance you saw McAtee missing tells you why. And then the first goal from Nunez, again, tells you why they're bottom of the league when they lose goals like that. Goalkeeper hitting the centre forward and the bottom of his foot and he goes in. Hey, at this stage of the game, actually, it's all about the result and Liverpool won.
Do you think as much as Klopp was being in that dressing room saying, listen, you know, he's got it in his head. I would imagine it's in his head, Klopp thinking, I got to find a way to make sure these players haven't switched off. Because at Sheffield United, they've been cannon fodder for a lot of teams. We've been super strong at home. We're, you know, any sort of mindset of we're just going to turn up and take five or six off them. I got to get that out. And I don't know if it was, you know, subconsciously as a player, it's, you just think it's going to happen, and then all of a sudden the game goes longer and longer and you don't get the second goal and it becomes frustrating and they get a bit of confidence. Right. And it seemed to me a little bit of that about it, that, you know, there's sometimes you lose a bit of energy. You know, if it's Man City at home, then the whole thing is just like, it's just revved up, right? And that comes through. But when it's Sheffield United at home, and the fans will be thinking it as well, they're turning up thinking, hey, six or seven tonight, and all of a sudden the sort of storyline changes. And I wonder if there's a wee bit of that about it.
Well, another thing is, you know, we shouldn't forget, we always talk about how great it is at Anfield on those crazy nights when the crowd takes the team across the line. The thing is, when you're playing in a game like this with 10 minutes to go and you're kind of dangling the Premier League title over the wall to drop it into the water and it's going to float away, you can feel that as well. Because everybody's thinking the same thing. Are we going to score here or what? What's going to happen? And so when you have 10 men behind the ball, all of a sudden it looks like they've got more than 10. Every way you turn, there's another like yellow jersey. So we shouldn't forget that the crowd as well as myself in this game was starting to question whether we were going to do it or not.
What a goal it was, though, from Alexis McAllister. Things looking good for him right now.
Yeah, he was in the press this week, and certainly Klopp was asked about him quite considerably, and how valuable he's been to this Liverpool team. Because of the fact that he's very flexible in where you can play him. And I think because Liverpool didn't get Lavia and Caicedo in the summer, coughs back again, he's been somewhat shuffled around a little bit and he's played maybe a little deeper at times than he wanted. But I think as the season's gone on, he has... And don't forget, at some points during the season... Liverpool have had three newbies in there. Mm-hmm. Endo, Szoboszlai, McAllister. And that's not easy. And I think he's grown into it and he's got more confident as he's gone along. And, you know, he's a World Cup winner, but he's a quality player.
What do you want to say about this game, Frank?
And I'm struggling.
Liverpool always showed during the season that at some point it's not they switched off, but they allow the team to put themselves in danger. But they have that reaction. It's where Liverpool are the best. Is they know how to react. They know how to put everything back to all together and how to finish the job. So. Even if I saw it was 1-1, I say, well, at some point they're going to find a way. Well, I never thought that would be a great goal like McAllister offered to us. But yeah, that was great. Just one thing about Van Dijk, and then maybe a red card or a yellow card. You know, I don't like when people take somebody on the neck. I think it's not nice. Yeah, for the example, you can push somebody if you're not happy. I'm sure he did that because he wanted to get rid of the player, was trying to hold him. But don't do that. I mean, it's not... I don't think it was in any danger. But for young players, for the young audience, that's not very nice. And you should be able to feel that and push him another way.
Yes, Stevie.
Yeah, make sure when you're pushing somebody, you think about the odd youngsters at home.
Yeah. Hey, next off, Manchester United.
To me, this is really straightforward. If Liverpool defend properly, they win this game comfortably. I mean, it's as simple as that. I mean, the last three, four times Liverpool are averaging three goals at Old Trafford in recent years. Three. So for them, not to win this game means they're going to have to be terrible defensively. And unfortunately, as I've said a couple of minutes ago, they keep giving teams opportunities. But what you can't do is you can't go away from home to Old Trafford and give Manchester United anything for free. Because it just gives them something to cling on to. If this is toe-to-toe football match, Liverpool wins the game. If you give Manchester United something to cling on to, they'll cling on to it. And they're also going to have 50,000 people helping them to cling on to it. So if Liverpool defend properly, Liverpool wins this game comfortably.
Well, you've talked about the Old Trafford factor recently and what it can do, especially when it's a team like Liverpool. We're going to take a look at Manchester United against Liverpool. Recent results at Old Trafford here.
Look at that, Craig. 13 goals in the last four visits.
Yeah, that Old that FA Cup game was crackers. The 4-3 looked like it was going to penalties till that goal right at the death. And look, we gave, and rightly so, we gave United a barrel load of credit for the way they hung in there and how clinical they were. But if you actually look back at the game, particularly the second half, there was a 20 to 25 minute period where Manchester United barely laid a glove on Liverpool in the middle of the park. The fact that the game was able to go the distance it went was because Liverpool were so sloppy and wasteful in the final third, right? And Salah was the main culprit, by the way, in that. He just come back from injury, but he was one of the main culprits. And so the 4-on-2s and the 5-on-2s that they had that they didn't take advantage of came back and bit them big time in the backside. And that will happen again at the weekend if they do the same thing, which is, you know, it's got to be fresh in Klopp's mind to say, listen, we cannot do at Old Trafford what we did. Mm. You know, the way they dominated in the middle of the park in the second half was scary. I mean, the rotation and the way that they passed it around in the little triangles, and I expect something similar. But as I said, this United side, as bad as they are, it's back to the wall stuff again. I mean, how many times this season? But it is. If they can't get up for this one.
And talking about it being back to the wall stuff, Frank, the fact that they lost this game, Manchester United, to Chelsea tonight, does that play any part in what's going to happen at Old Trafford on Sunday? Does it affect this game in any way?
For sure. And not in a bad way for Manchester. In a very good way. I think they will have to react. And they know they play against their main rival, so they're going to be up for it. And they're going to fight, like, very hard. And maybe they would have won against Chelsea. They would have been a little bit less, more relaxed because less pressure. But they know that they cannot do what they showed, what they did today and showed to the world. They have to react. It's Manchester United overall. They have to show against Liverpool that they have to be better. And it's a big game. They're not going to be as bad as today. And it's going to be troubles for Liverpool. But I'm with Craig. If Liverpool plays the way they should play, if they don't get sloppy, they're going to win that game.
Are you concerned this could be a factor, United's loss tonight?
Not really. No, I kind of look at it the opposite way to Frank. You know, when you lose a game like this, somehow you feel a little bit more tired. And I know it's Liverpool and you should get up for it, but I think it takes a little bit out of you. So I'm not concerned. Listen, had it been 5-0, had Manchester United lost 4 or 5-0, I think that's when the opposite thing happens. Because you're embarrassed, then it makes a difference when you walk in the next game. I think when you lose a game like this, I think it takes it out of you a little bit more. Just a little bit more. So I'm not worried about a backlash. I'm actually 100% confident that this is in Liverpool's hands. And I don't think what Man United do is going to influence this game. It's going to be what Liverpool maybe don't do. It's going to decide who wins or whether they get a result out of this.
Well, listen, hold on. Varane, probably not going to be available.
Johnny Evans
came on 20 odd minutes. Cav, I think it was, had to go off.
Manu looked tired tonight, didn't he?
You know, Casemiro can't get around. You know, they've already got the injuries at the back to Lindelof and Shaw and Malacia and others. They've got the back line was Martinez. The back line was already struggling. We've got a goalkeeper who's not playing particularly well. If we're being honest, the shots he saved tonight were the ones that he should have saved straight at him. And certainly the first Chelsea goal went right under him, so he's not exactly feeling anybody full of confidence. Hoyland are run about up front. And I know, you know, Rashford was left out tonight. Ten Hag said he was giving them a rest. Is anybody batting an eyelid? You know, even if Rashford wasn't on the bus, nobody'd really bat an eyelid. So it's in Liverpool's hands. You know, at the end of the day, it's not a Man United side that's going to scare anybody. Anybody at Old Trafford. Nobody. So it's up to... It's what Liverpool do. If they do what they're really, really good at, they will put this team to bed pretty early. If they don't, they might suffer the same fate as they did in the FA Cup.
Now, the title is in Liverpool's hands right now, and when it comes to the odds, they are the favourites. Manchester City, second favourites, even though they are third in the table. And then, of course, Arsenal follows. Where are we standing on this right now, Frank?
Well, I changed my mind because I always put City until the last game that City played against Arsenal. I put them as favourites, but I still think that City is going to finish before Arsenal. I still have... It's crazy because you can see that, and today we saw that with Liverpool, we saw that yesterday with Man City. I think Arsenal are very strong defensively. With Gabriel and Saliba, they can secure, they can get clean sheet, where the other teams are struggling to not concede goals. And but offensively, I feel the other more armed than Arsenal. So I see Liverpool because there is something special there coming up. As I explained, yeah, they can struggle. They can be open sometimes against even Sheffield United. But we all know that they will react. They will get something, maybe it's called pride, which make them reacting well. So I see them finishing first, City second, and Arsenal third.
Yeah, like tonight, Stevie, it might not be comfortable. But they might come out on top anyway.
Well, they've kind of done that most of the season. Most of the season, something's been put in their way, whether it's an injury or whatever it may be, and they've come up with an answer, the same way they did tonight. But the fact is, in their hands, I guess... Listen, whether it was if Arsenal or City had been sitting at the top of the league and been in the position they're in, I would make them favourites. The fact that Liverpool are sitting top, they have to be favourites. It's theirs to lose. Just that's the truth.
It would be some achievement, though, would it not? And I'm not, you know, I've no dog in this race, really. I mean, Liverpool, Arsenal, City. You know, Arsenal and City were both up there neck and neck last year until the Saliba injury and a bit of tiredness. And we know how strong City were, you know, winning FA Cup, the league and the Champions League. Blowing everybody away, blew Real Madrid away, and that's going to be a great tie coming up in the Champions League, which is taking a slightly different turn because, you know, Real Madrid are playing well and City, they're sort of up and down a little bit. But for Liverpool to come back from where they were and also to play a lot of the season, and I know a lot of teams have had injuries, and Frank mentioned the Arsenal back four, which, by the way, at the weekend was incredible, particularly the two centre-halves. And Liverpool have been the opposite. You know, you look at their back four during a lot of this season, it's been decimated. Centre-halves, full-backs, goalkeeper, you know, the Asian Cup, the African Cup of Nations, they were affected by all these things, and yet they're top of the league coming from where they were. And if Klopp was to pull this off, particularly with two really strong teams neck and neck, it's not like there's only one team, there's two strong teams in there, I think it would be by far, in a way, his best achievement, not only at Liverpool, but in football. It would be unbelievable. But there's a long way to go.
What a running it is going to be. These guys are answering your questions on the latest edition of Extra Time. We had a lot of questions coming in for them after the games we saw on Thursday. Make sure to check it out over on our YouTube channel every single day.
Now, let's talk about the play of the week. The pressure to follow up Hypnotic and Cognac, weighing heavy on the team. Hypnotic was in the cup, blue and ready for the play. And, boom! Añejo Tequila came in with a smooth assist to Hypnotic's tropical fruit finish. Shaken, strained, poured. It was green and good! The playmaking splash shifted the tempo. Another great cocktail from the Hypnotic team. Every season is Hypnotic and tequila season. Hypnotic Liqueur, Bardstown, Kentucky, 17% alcohol by volume. Hypnotic reminds you to think wisely, drink wisely.
Wednesday night on ABC, Brittany Griner, for the first time since being released from a Russian prison, shares her story.
You've been told to go through your bag, and you felt...
Felt the cartridge.
What were you thinking at that moment when you felt that?
My life is over right here.
Her sentence.
Just been told you're going to be 9 years in one of the worst prisons in Russia.
I was just so scared for everything, because there's just so much unknown.
Brittany Griner, Robin Roberts, Prisoner in Russia, Wednesday night at 10, 9 central on ABC.
Copa del Rey final coming up on Saturday's Athletic Club against Mallorca, 3:30 p.m. Eastern. Be sure to be with us for the showpiece there. A lot of Bundesliga action to get you through as well on Saturday. Playing at the same time, we'll have Bayern and Bayer Leverkusen against Heidenheim and Union Berlin, respectively. Coverage around both of those games, followed by coverage around Borussia Dortmund against a standout Stuttgart this season. Every single game, as always, available on ESPN+. And yes, Derek Ray will be on the call this weekend for Bayern's game.
Is it a Meisterspiel?
Top Spiel, Craig. Oh,
a top spiel.
Stick around, extra time on the way. These guys are answering your questions. Welcome into the latest edition of Extra Time. We have Craig and Stevie here.
Well, we coughed our way through that.
Craig's got a cough again.
Where did that come from? He only coughed all day.
Yeah, a tickly cough.
Yeah, 100-day cough, it sounds like.
Yeah, it went away.
And it came back.
Came back.
To say hello. Frank Leboff is with us as well, yeah. Our director's saying you need a little bit of lemon.
Yeah, with some whiskey in it.
Yeah, you won't say no to that.
And honey.
All right. Let's get your questions up then. I've not got them in front of me, but we'll read them.
I'm bitter enough.
There we go. What have we got to
Desperate not to agree with you there, by the way.
Oh, here we go. First question. Have you ever seen a team shut off as often as Manchester United? And is that more of a reflection on the manager or the players? Stevie.
Players. Absolutely, players. Set pieces against, everybody has a job, but everybody's job is to be alert for anything that's happening or anything that they think may happen. That's the rules. But in this game, not one Manchester United player was alert, and not one of them clearly was watching what was happening. I mean, just... It's about as unprofessional as it gets.
Craig and Frank, be honest. If you were fans at Stamford Bridge today, would you have left the game early when Manchester United had the lead?
Go on, Frank.
No, I don't think so. I always want to see until the end of it. I never understood that. If you want to come to watch a game, you know, go till the end. I mean, that's what it is, and you have to accept to lose a game. But I would have stayed. Craig?
Well, I wouldn't have been there in the first place. Well, if I was a fan, which I hate, as a lot of people obviously love going, that's what they do. They've been doing it for years, a lot of them. And travel home and away, all these supporters, it's quite amazing the passion they have for it. But I understand to an extent sometimes when people leave, but when it's tight, I can see it when it's 4 or 5 nil. You know, a team's getting battered, they go, oh,
yeah.
But when you have a chance, like Chelsea fans have left thinking, how the hell are we get beaten by this Man United side? You know what I mean? At home, blah, 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 with all their injuries. And then all of a sudden, there's some great story at the end, for Chelsea anyway, and you've missed it. Now, the only thing that's... The only saviour is if you're in the pub early and the bar's not... And you get you get a quick pint in, you know, just to help. But no, I don't get it when it's... Maybe it's travel for some of them, I don't know. Tubes, last tube, travel, I don't know.
Stevie, you got away with answering this one in the main show. Why didn't Virgil van Dijk receive a red card?
I don't know. I've got to be honest, at the time when I'm watching the game, I'm thinking, he's in trouble here. You can't grab anybody by the throat. So, I guess the only thing I can say is, this game was at Anfield. If this had been away from home, I think we're possibly looking it's something else. I mean, yeah, I can't talk my way out of him. I can't honestly turn round and say to him, if I'm his coach and he comes in, I'm going to say to him, by the way, you just got away with one, because you can't touch anybody, you can't put your hands around anybody's throat. That's the only defence I've got.
Right, but the old defence, when the referee, you know when they used to sing, I've got to get this right. No, I won't use the terminology, because it could be construed a different way. But the referee will give the home side the home advantage. I'm not saying that's correct, but that's the perception.
That's the reality.
There's a guy, well, yeah, maybe a reality, but then in the modern game, there is a guy who is also officiating, who's in London, and he's not going to get affected by an irate crowd who could have told the official to go and look at the monitor and potentially send the player off, which he didn't do either, it seems, because otherwise the referee, and I don't believe he was, sent over to the monitor to have a second look.
It's kind of the same as, you know, we're talking in the show about the penalty kicks.
Yep.
And we were both talking about when you get on the wrong side, you can't make any contact because you don't have an argument.
Right.
This is the exact same thing. When you put your hand on somebody's throat, I don't care whether you're tickling them or what you're doing, the fact that your hands are on his throat is an absolute and utter no-no. Yeah. And you can't defend it.
No. And he clearly wasn't thinking of the kids watching at home, Frank.
No.
Yes. The example, you know, that's true. That's true, Kate. But I really think that he didn't get the red card because everything was done like in slow motion with very calmness, you know, from Van Dijk. That he put his throat, you know, put the guy down. The guy laid down, didn't move, and Van Dijk behaved like nothing happened. So people thought, yeah, okay, that wasn't that bad. So. Let's carry on.
He sold it well.
But bad example for the kids.
He sold it well.
Stevie, with Liverpool in the league title fight with Arsenal and Man City and top four assured, does Klopp use the Europa League to rest some players and make the Premier League a priority?
Ooh.
Ooh, good question.
Aye.
Because Liverpool are in the Europa League this year.
I know now. You keep reminding me. Oh, that's a toughie, by the way. I'm going to say if he can do it in certain areas without much of a change, you know, like don't play Slobber's Eye, you can play Elliot, and it's not too big of an impact. I think he might try it. But the problem is, you can't pick and choose when and when you don't win. And I think when you get to this stage,
Stevie,
of the season, you play your best team.
Stevie, was it a question in our time, your time, and Craig is my time. to wonder, we're going to play European Cup or Premier League or FA Cup? We wanted to play all. And the
full steam ahead.
Never wondered. Yeah, exactly.
Full steam ahead.
So yeah, why it's, now? It's, why nowadays because, you have to think about that?
Because that's what they do. You know, people are talking.
They don't play.
People are talking
they
about
don't play
Erling
more
Haaland.
Game that we used to.
No, I know, but it's just a different mindset now. Like Haaland, for example. I heard people talking today about, oh, why was Haaland sitting on the bench smiling, and he looked like he was joking with his mates and the whole thing. Now. Again, another time, if that had been Kenny Dalglish or Ian Rush and they were on the bench, I'll tell you what, they'd be creating havoc. They would not. You wouldn't know, the whole place would know. But it's a different mindset now. It's a completely different mindset. You're not playing, I'm going to arrest you. Okay, it's okay. We would have been, hold on a second, what are you talking about? Just, it's a different...
Yeah.
They go about it a completely different way.
He'll definitely prioritise, though, the Premier League.
I think so.
Yeah, oh, yeah. What you got to understand now is, the difference is the little gremlin in Klopp's ear and every manager's ear, it seems, is something that wasn't there 15 years ago, maybe 10, 15, certainly 20, was sports scientists telling a manager in the morning, every morning, that so-and-so has overplayed, so-and-so has overplayed, so-and-so probably going to get an injury if he plays. And that seed of doubt is now in the manager's mind, which it was never. You know, he used to gauge it with, it was the eye test, or the physio got pulled and said, right, what's the scenario with the injured players? And if you, back in the day, and it doesn't seem like 50 years ago, but back in the day before all the sports scientists, you were either fit in training or you were not. Nowadays, even if you're fit, you could be debatable whether you're fit enough depending what zone you're in, right, with your blood testing and all the things they do, the lactic acid.
Well, look at Tyler Adams with the US team. He's only allowed to play 39 minutes. Where'd that come from? I mean, who decided that? Clearly wasn't the manager.
39.
It was 39 minutes. That's what they said.
It was limited. His ceiling. Because he was out for almost a year.
His ceiling was 39 minutes. I mean, really?
Well, that's insane.
The
that's
scientists.
Insane.
Scientists. Hi. Well, nobody's here. Yeah. Scientists.
Who would be the guys signing of the season in the Premier League? Some notable ones are Rice, Palmer, Maddison, Kudus, and McAllister.
Right.
So it's dollar.
Well, after the game tonight, you have to put Palmer. Sorry. After the game tonight, you have to put Palmer, but definitely Rice has to be put maybe there, because how much he worked in the middle of the park for the Gunners made the difference this season comparing to last season. So I would say Rice and Palmer.
I'm still thinking.
All right, it has to be either Palmer or McAllister, because the money has to come into it. You know, well, let's be honest, you've paid 100 million for Rice. He better be doing his job. You know, he better be for 100 million. And that's got nothing to do with Caicedo and Enzo Fernandez not doing their job. They were 100 million. But at the end of the day, it's 100 mil. You've got Palmer and McAllister, who both have gone for around about the same type of money. And I think Palmer was a little bit more. So I think, listen, I'm obviously a little bit biased, but I think McAllister.
McAllister. Well, that's the statement of the year, isn't it?
No, but let me tell you why.
Holy smokes.
McAllister has been involved in the game for 90 minutes. As great as Cole Palmer is, he disappears at times. But he's only a kid. He's still a young player. Maybe that'll come. So, surprise, surprise, I'm going with McAllister.
I would throw in, I think Kudus for sure. I would throw in, although he's had the odd injury, if we're bringing the financial side into it as well, has there been a better value for money than Van de Ven at Tottenham? I mean, when he's not on that side, he's been absolutely outstanding. Hamstring issues apart, he has been a great signing for them. Mm. Now, what's better, I mean, for each team? Try to think anywhere else. Not off the top of my head. But yeah, there have been some good signings.
So who are you picking?
Are you all right?
That's your question, isn't it?
So you pick McAllister. You pick Palmer. All right. For value for money, I'm going to say Van de Ven.
OK. Stevie, why not Pep Linders? Didn't Fagan prove a long-time assistant can be the answer and provide continuity? Also, how did you like Fagan, and what did the players think of him taking the reins at the time?
Absolutely. Yeah. No, well, Paisley took over from Shankly, so that kind of broke that stigma. So, to everybody, it seemed a logical move. And I mean, listen, if Joe spoke to you when he was the coach, he was talking to you for a reason, and you listened because you knew what he was talking about. So it never changed when he became the manager. It was the exact same thing. So yeah, no, it was just seemed the sensible and smart thing to do. Linders, I would not have argued had he gotten the job, or had they come out and said Pep Linders is going to take over, because I think the players would probably Actually, let me backtrack a second. I guess it depends on the relationship that Lindus has with the players. Let me put it that way. Because if he's too friendly with the players, because there always has to be a go-between. Like Paul and I. Paul was always closer to the players than I was.
Because I had to be
the bad cop. It depends. It depends how close Lindus is to the players. If you're too close, it doesn't work. But if he wasn't, if he was basically the second coming of Joe Fagan, then I would have no problem with him taking over.
Might he be in your top three when you see the list of the managers that are in line for it?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I honestly never thought about it previously. So this question came up. But now that it's come up, I would have no problem with it.
Have we got a list? Or was that an imaginary list?
But we do have a list. We've had a list on my last show of Liverpool's...
All the odds and all that. Yeah.
He's on the list, though, isn't he? I just can't remember where he is on it.
So is Zinedine Zidane. Not that he's a bad manager,
yeah,
he's not.
Yeah. For Craig, start bench or sell Jude Bellingham, Foden, Cole Palmer based on their current season?
Wow.
Well, you know. To be honest, just player level alone, I'm selling Cole Palmer. You know, not but he's been great. There'd been an easy answer a few weeks ago, wouldn't it?
Mm.
But it'd been Jude Bellingham. I'm gonna start Phil Foden. I don't know if I am.
Mm.
Bench Bellingham, drop Palmer.
Do you agree?
No, I would start Bellingham and bench Foden.
Frank, you get the final say.
Yeah, I'm gonna go for Jude Bellingham. Foden second and Palmer. Palmer, he has the disadvantage of playing for a club is mid-table. That's why he's not at the top of the top. But the Bellingham influence in the middle of the park has been huge for most of the season for Real Madrid. We are talking about Real Madrid. So Bellingham first, yeah.
There is one more question from a big fan. It's from Derek Ray. For you, Craig.
What's Derek's name in German?
Is he
Heinrich Reis?
Tell me something. This is a burner account, isn't it?
No, it's Ray.com. Look.
He's not saying.
40 games unbeaten and no sign of a defeat forthcoming. A Leverkusen on current form, the best team in Europe. Regards to my fellow Scots and favourite Frenchman.
There's a word for that in Germany. Nice. The best team. What was it?
That's a little sweetener at the end as well, my fave Frenchman.
Right.
Are they the best team in Europe?
They're the most informed team in Europe.
Right. Well, think back to Arsenal.
We don't know.
When they were invincible. Were they the best team in Europe? They didn't win the Champions League. They were just unbeaten in the Premier League.
These guys are unbeaten in every single competition.
What I'd say is, in England at the moment, we have the best title race out of all the leagues. But in some essence, in Germany, we have maybe the best story. Could that be both things be true?
And they're 13 points ahead of Bayern.
Purely in the fact that Bayern have been running away with this thing for so long. And where Leverkusen were when Alonso took over and where they are now has been some achievement. Almost as big an achievement as managed to hold on to this cough for an eternity. So I don't know.
Could they beat Liverpool in the Europa League?
Oh yeah.
They could, huh?
Go on, Frank.
Leverkusen are 13 points ahead of a team who's still in the Champions League. So he has to count on what you want to think about, because you're not 13 points ahead in a German league against nobody. Bayern, wherever they are right now, they're still in the Champions League. So it says a lot about the power of this Leverkusen team. But yeah, I don't know if they are the best, but they're one of the best for sure.
And it's not just the fact that at the top, you know, obviously they've lost some key players as well, particularly Boniface for a long period. You have Patrick Schick there. Florian Wirtz has been brilliant. Grimaldo on the left side. With so many amazing performances. But how many times have they actually won games late on?
Yeah, a lot. That's why it gets to a point where they'll be trailing and you just still feel...
They just keep going and keep going. Like this show.
You're good.
Just keeps going.
All right. Leverkusen are brilliant. But the guys are not going to quite be drawn on saying they're the best team in Europe right now. Sorry, Derek.
Heinrich, his name's Heinrich.
All right, sorry, Heinrich.
Heinrich Reis.
He's tweeted that from Germany, from Cologne.
Cologne. Craig, come on. Thanks so much for sending in your questions. We'll be back tomorrow to do it all over again.
Wednesday night on ABC, Brittany Griner, for the first time since being released from a Russian prison, shares her story.
You've been told to go through your bag, and you felt...
Felt the cartridge.
What were you thinking at that moment when you felt that?
My life is over right here.
Her sentence.
Just been told you're going to be 9 years in one of the worst prisons in Russia.
I was just so scared for everything, because there's just so much unknown.
Brittany Griner, Robin Roberts, Prisoner in Russia. Wednesday night at 10, 9 central on ABC.